So over the last 2 weeks, I talked to you about computational modeling of neural circuits, mostly microcircuits, in certain parts of the brain, like prefrontal cortex, that are important for cognitive functions. Relatively simple, what I call elemental, but core cognitive functions, especially decision-making and working memory. Today and next week, we're going to discuss how we can go from local circuits to large-scale brain systems. This is a pretty new research direction, I would say, certainly in my lab. So I'm going to explain to you how we went about doing that and what we have learned so far. The motivation is twofold. For one thing, if you're interested in functions, right? For one thing, any cognitive function, such as working memory representation, is now increasingly recognized as something that's not just local within one area, but involves multiple brain regions. If you do a delay task and you do imaging or single neuron physiology or recording from multiple neurons, you will find that working memory related activity is observed and present in multiple brain regions, right? How does that work? Is, I would say, poorly understood, both at the level of biological mechanism and the computational principle. Of course, each cognitive function, be it variation in choice, in behavioral choice, or executive control, or language, involves a subset of brain regions, and all these different functions have to work together to generate flexible behavior, right? So this is just say that we do need to understand how such a distributed system really works. And of course, people know that, people have been studying that, but I would argue that only now we have the proper rigorous data for us to really build interesting models, right? That's biologically based, that's constrained by data. So I'm going to explain how we went about doing this. And in particular, I will talk about a phenomenon that we found in the model we built, namely the emergence of a hierarchy of time constants, which I think is pretty interesting. It has a lot of implications, including how you interpret functional data, functional connectivity data. Along the way, I will provide evidence of different levels, actually including analysis of gene expressions in the brain, in support of the idea of what we call macroscopical gradients, namely biological properties seem to vary systematically along certain axes in the cortical tissue, which might be a general principle of a large-scale cortical circuit organization of broad computational implications, I think. So let me start with structure. As you know, these days there's a field, a whole field called connectomics, devoted to study connections in the brain at different levels, microscopic, mesoscopic, and macroscopic, right? So for example, there's this diffusion tensor imaging technique that allows you to measure the fibers and quantify the connectivity in the brain in human subjects, non-invasively, right? So this is tremendously important. I'm going to tell you how this kind of data, but not really DTI data, is the structure basis to build a dynamical model. But I thought it probably is useful for some here to say that structure is important, but it's not so obvious how do you go from structure to functions, to behavior, right? So to drive home the point, I'd like to give you a very simple toy example. This is a simple neural network with two neurons that are exactly the same and that talk to each other through inhibition, right? So you can say, this is the connectomics of the system. Can you predict the behavior from this connectomics, right? Actually, this is a motif very common in central pattern generators to generate rhythmic movement, like walking left, right, left, right. So the way it works is that one of the two neurons is active in time and suppresses the other, but over time, that unit will become fatigued, right? So the other neuron will take over and suppresses the first one in turn. So there's this alternation of activity between the two neuron groups giving you this, you know, A, B rhythm, right? So that's well known for a long time, all the way from invertebrates, small species, you know, animals. Now, can you think about a different mode of operation in the same system given the same connectomics? What if neurons don't adapt? What if they don't, they get fatigued, right? So if they don't get fatigued, the system can serve as a switch, a flip-flop, right? So one neuron is active until an input switches on the other unit, which in turn suppresses you know, the first unit, right? So there's a switch, either A is up and B is down all the time, or vice versa. So the same connectomics, if you like, right? Depending on the dynamics of the neurons, it could either behave this way or that way. Now, to a big surprise, actually, of the community, there's a third regime. If the synapses are dynamical and somewhat slow, actually, the two units can fire in perfect synchrony, spike by spike, in time together, in spite of the fact that they talk to each other through inhibition, right? So the way it works is that the two neurons fire a spike, they send each other inhibition, and they stop, right, for a while, and the inhibition decays away, they can fire a spike again together, right? So actually, this synchrony may emerge from the same kind of circuit, which would be counterintuitive, right? So this, I think, gives you, I think, give me certainly an example that the structure is important, but you need something else. We need both in neuroscience, right? The two major pillars of neuroscience is anatomy, connectomics on one hand, and physiology, dynamical understanding of the system on the other hand. Of course, plasticity is part of the dynamics. So we decided to collaborate with a group in Lyon, in France, actually, led by Henry Kennedy, to build a model of multi-regional cortex or macaque cortex. They recently published a series of papers, largely based on thesis work by Nikolai Markov, where they used rather traditional anatomical method, but came up with very, very nice connectivity matrix. Let me just briefly describe to you the method. What they do is to inject a dye in one area, let's call it a target area, that retrogradely go back to areas that project to this target area, right? So you can call those source areas. Let's say in this example, there are six areas that project to the target area, and you can count the labeled neurons in each area as a proxy about the strength of a connection from one source area to a target area, right? So if you say the target area is D, and those are the labeled neurons in proportion, right? From source areas, you can use this number, so-called FLN, as a measure of the weight of connection from each of these areas to the target area. So the point is that this is a connectivity matrix that's directed, right? So, you know, say from A to B, but not necessarily from B to A, and weighted. They also had a way to measure the relationship between areas in a hierarchy. Maybe you are familiar with this notion that in the primate, certainly, that the cortex are organized along certain hierarchy, right? For visual system, the input goes to V1, which in turn projects to V2. V2 projects to, say, MT and V4, etc., right? You know, and the way they quantify that is to use the same data, but this time based on the notion that a feed-forward projection tends to come from the top parts of the cortex, so superficial layers, whereas the feedback projection tends to originate from deep layers. So they just ask, for each source area, what's the fraction of labeled neurons are coming from superficial layer versus the total? All right? That provides a quantitative measure. From there, they deduced a the relationship between areas, say A and B, whether one is lower or higher in the hierarchy. And they did that pair by pair for each pair of the areas they examined, and they come up with this measure of hierarchy for all cortical areas they have so far examined. That way you have a notion of hierarchy, in the cortex. right? So they have done this so far for about 30 areas, and you know, with the weighted directed connection matrix called FLN, they found that, for example, the weights of connections span 5 orders of magnitude, as shown here, that's fit with a log normal distribution. So some connection weights are strong, some are weak, right, with a big range. And also, the weight of connection between any pair of areas, AB, is an exponential distance function of the distance or wiring length between the two, right? So what that says is that the connections are really dependent on the physical or wiring distance between two areas. It's not just a purely topological network, right? Where you have a bunch of nodes and you worry about the connections, but you don't really worry about spatial proximity, right? So you don't think about the connection in terms of spatial embedding. So that's the contrast I want to draw between this kind of database and the kind of connectivity matrix that many people use, right? This is from a review by Oliver Spohns, where you know, sometimes, not always, but very often, you care about the presence or absence of connections, and the connections tend to be symmetrical, right? Like, you know, the data from DTI, for example, is a symmetrical matrix without directional information. So in contrast, again, just say it one more time, to say I just said, this new database, the Markov Kennedy connectivity matrix, if you like, is directed, weighted, and distance dependent. Finally, the connections are rather dense, and that's going to come back, you know, when we talk about functions. So the out of all possible connections between pairs of areas, about 66% of connections are there, right? So it's not very sparse. That's going to have some computational implications. Based on this type of data, Francis Song in the lab developed a new class of mathematical network models that capture this spatial embedding. It's a very interesting model, I think, but maybe I should not spend too much time on the details of how he built that model, just to say that he started with a three-dimensional cortical tissue model, really a continuum, and then build a model in which you kind of grow axons between areas based on a simple mathematical model, and then see if this kind of model, right, can capture the experimental observations. So let me just show you this slide, comparing the model with the monkey data. What's shown here is the sequence of input degree and output degree. Input degree for each area is simply how many areas project to this area. That's the input degree. And output degree is simply how many areas that this area projects back out, right? Okay, and the input degree, output degree sequence is very similar to what you see in the real data. This is the FLN as function of the inter-area wiring distance, right, with this wide distribution of weights. And finally, this so-called motif distribution with three nodes, okay, three areas. So you can ask, what's the you know, the fraction of A to B pair that's connected, et cetera, right? So you have all these different motifs with different proportion, and you find, I found surprising that the model actually captures this kind of statistics. So let's take this as the structure constraint for the dynamic model I'm going to build, right? So I'm going to use FLN as a connectivity matrix for the model I'm going to build. Now the next question is, to build a model, how do you describe dynamics in each local area, right? So we would start with this common theme in cortical physiology, which says that in a way, to some degree, cortex are all the same, even between species like rodent and the primate, to some degree, I said. And so in that sense, the cortex is a repetition of a universal canonical microcircuit with a lot of repeats, right? And that's, if true, right, a very powerful idea. And that's advocated by many people, including Douglas and Martin. But on the other hand, we're going to follow this principle when we build a model with a twist. That's, you know, on the other hand, part of the story. We would say that maybe there are some quantitative changes from area to area. What's interesting, what I'm going to show you, is that if you introduce heterogeneity across areas in a model, then quantitative differences in the properties, in biological properties, that may determine, say, excitation or inhibition, will have interesting implications because of this kind of nonlinear dynamical systems. You can have what's called bifurcation phenomena in mathematics. And that allows you to have the emergence of novel behavior based on quantitative differences, right? We actually, came from this tradition, which involved many other people, of course, in the field, including Van Zandt, for example, and perhaps many others in the audience, that in physics, there's this bifurcation phenomena, right? Let me give you an example from the local circuit modeling I talked to you about previously. So remember when I talk about local circuit model, I talk about the strength of recurrent excitation, right? So if the strength of recurrent excitation is too weak, then you don't have self-sustained persistent activity. But if you just change this parameter, if you like, above some threshold, you have this emergence of persistent activity patterns. Right? So this is an example of bifurcation. And so we're going to try to introduce some kind of parameter change from area to area, right, quantitatively based on data. So that's our approach. So what's the data that would allow us to introduce variations of properties? One of the data set we used is coming from Elston in Australia. So what he did is simply to count the number of spines per neuron, right? You know that the spines are the small protrusions in the dendrites of pyramidal cells. Those are the sites of excitatory synapses. So you can think about the number of spines as, you know, roughly speaking, right, the number of excitatory synapses per neuron, right? That turns out to be very different depending on which area you're looking at, right? So the number of spines per neuron in this example, in layer 3 pyramidal cell is, this, and number of spines is that for V2, et cetera, et cetera. If I plot the number of spines per neuron against the hierarchical position of cortical areas, you see this very strong increase correlation, right? So we're going to feed this data in a curve and use that as a proxy of the for the strength of excitation per neuron in each of the areas in our computational model. All right? So now the strength of excitation is no longer the same in the model, but it's going to change from area to area in the model we're building. I want to mention that recently we did similar kind of analysis and found the same thing with marmoset monkey. Some experimental study reproduced the Elston data. I'm going to skip the details of this very interesting work, actually, where they compared V1 and the prefrontal cortex. And they found exactly the same thing as Elston, that the number of spines per neuron in the prefrontal cortex is much larger than the number of spines per neuron in V1. And then they did the same thing in mice between V1 and the frontal area. They found no difference between the two. So I walk you through already the steps that we went through to build this model. Right? We used the CIJ, it's the connectivity matrix from Kennedy's group, as the matrix for long distance connections. And we build a local circuit model for each area, which is the same, right? It's following the idea of canonical circuit. But then certain things change from area to area. This is an example of macroscopic gradient that scales with the excitation strength based on the spine count data. For this example, the model is extremely simple. It's a threshold linear model, but each local circuit has an E population and an I population with all four possible connections, E to E, E to I, I to E, and I to I. All right? That is the first version of the model that we built, spearheaded by Rishi Chaudhary, a graduate student. So let's see the simulation result of this model. This is the behavior of the model given an input to V1. So if you're receiving a visual input, V1 responds vigorously, right, quickly. And so different sample areas are different color here as function of time. You see that the time course actually is quite different from area to area, right? V1, responds quickly, but decays away quickly as well. But some other areas show this kind of slower response. Now you can call that ramping activity, almost linear ramping activity, which we talked about in decision-making discussion. And some areas like this one, which is from ACC, part of the prefrontal cortex, it shows this very gradual ramping activity. And when input is gone, it keeps present for quite some time, right? Slow decay as a short memory trace of the stimulus. You can simulate the system in a different way, where you generate spontaneous activity by driving every single area with noise. And now you see that the fluctuations of response seem to be somewhat different, slower in the frontal area compared to V1. So to quantify that, you can compute the autocorrelation function for each area. You will get a curve like this that tells you how the signals become decorrelated when you separate them in time, right? And from there, you can extract the time constant, right, that dominates the fluctuations in each area. So again, areas are indicated by different color. So the extracted time constant from here is shown over here for areas arranged around the hierarchy. So some areas like V1 show very short time constant. This is some log plot, right? 20 milliseconds, whereas some other areas show pretty long time constant. It's useful to mention that the time constant from each area is not a monotonic function of the hierarchical position, right? So for example, this one, the light purple, is part of the frontal eye field. It's actually rather low in hierarchy, but because it's part of the frontal lobe, it interacts with many other frontal areas that are slow, right? So as a result, the dynamics is rather slow. So this really is a pattern that depends on multiple factors, including long-distance connections, which I will demonstrate more explicitly later. So just to briefly mention that functionally, that's what you want, right? For early sensory areas like retina or V1, you want the time constant of the system to be very fast, to be short, so that you can process information that changes all the time in the environment. On the other hand, we talk about this quasi-linear ramping activity in decision-making that assumes that you need a very slow time constant, right, on the order of a second or so. And somehow, this, the model I talked to you about naturally gives a rise to this hierarchy of time constants. Now you can start to think about, what this hierarchy of time constants might be good for. One idea we're currently exploring is related to the role of feedbacks. What's shown here is from a review by Gilbert and Lee, showing feed-forward projections in the visual system in blue and feedback projections in red, giving you the impression that there's a lot of feedback projections, right, in the visual system, which, by the way, has not really been understood well and, say, applied to artificial intelligence, right? Deep networks are mostly deep feed-forward networks. So the kind of systems we talk about here today and next week, if you like, are the deep recurrent networks. But if you think about, for example, the idea of predictive coding, which says that maybe the brain is not a passive receiver of information, and somehow higher areas constantly try to guess and predict what's going to happen next through top-down projections, then we can take into consideration now the new knowledge that different areas have different timescales, right? So maybe the prediction signals from different areas to early sensory areas would have memory over time on different timescales, right? That could be interesting. For example, if you watch a video, you try to predict what's going to happen next, right? Based on what you have seen before, right? Through this kind of mechanism. We also found that the hierarchy of time constants actually is not unique in a way, because say if you stimulate some of the sensory pathway in this system rather than visual pathway, now V1 is very slow. That may be better shown here. So what's shown here is the time scale of response in color for different areas in the model. Right? I should mention that so far the anatomical analysis by Kennedy's group has been limited to about 30 areas. So our model is really a model of a sub-network of the cortex so far. So that's why you don't see all the areas in this kind of plot. This is an activity map, if you like. But here the color represent the speed of response, right? So if the input is visual, then you see that the backside of the cortex, like V1, is dark, very fast. But if the input is somewhat sensory, the backside is yellow, very slow. That's because in that case, the signal has to propagate, right, along the somewhat sensory pathway, and through the feedback projections, eventually will come back to visual areas, perhaps, right? So the time scales really depend on how you stimulate the system and potentially maybe flexibly modulated somehow. In the model, we could try to make some progress in understanding what are the major factors about the circuit properties underlying this hierarchy of time constants. So for example, we can compare to the intact network, take out feedbacks in the model, right? Then you will find that the maximum time constant is shrinked quite a bit, right? So the hierarchy becomes more flat. If you take out all the long distance projections, the hierarchy becomes even more flat. And also now you see that because there's no long distance connections, the time constant is a monotonic function, right, of the hierarchical position of cortical areas. Another manipulation we did is compared to control in black, you preserve the same connective matrix in terms of elements, but randomly shuffle them, right? So you have the same set of weights, you just randomly reassign them, right? In that case, you get a blue curve. So the range of time constants and the organization is totally different, right? Showing that the actual pattern of time scales is really dependent on the, you know, specific statistical properties of a connective matrix. We tried to test this idea of hierarchy. In our hands, we tried to look at a single unit from behaving monkeys. This is a result plot from that data analysis study. So in that case, it's a bit tricky to compare single unit data from different experiments. So we collaborated with like five monkey labs. And we look at the neural data only during fixation period before a trial starts. That's perhaps a condition that's common, shared across monkey experiments. And then we analyzed the time scale of fluctuations of activity during fixation period from different cortical areas. And we have found evidence, indeed, the intrinsic time constant during resting state, if you like, at the level of single units, show this hierarchy of time constants. On the other side, actually, before our modeling work, there was a very interesting human studies, including this one from NYU, actually, before I moved to NYU, where they did a human study showing humans to watch a silent movie. And what they did is to manipulate the movie through scrambling segments of movie on different time scales, right? 4 seconds, 12 seconds, 36 seconds. The idea is that at the same time they do functional MRI imaging, right? The idea is that if you look at both signal from one area that is, rather slow, right? Then the manipulation within that time scale should not affect what you see, right, at the both signal level. But on the other hand, if the scrambling happens at time scale much slower than the intrinsic time scale of the system, you should see the difference, right? And this is what they found, without going into details, that the Bose signal is affected by the scrambling depends on cortical areas, and that is consistent with the idea of hierarchy of time constants. There's another line of the study studied with Yuri Hansen about speech processing. They also found evidence in that case. They used either ECOG recording or MEG. They found that different parts of the cortical areas of cortex that are involved with understanding words, phrases, sentences seem to have different timescales of integration of information. So mathematically, you can ask the question, what are the properties that are required for this hierarchy of time constant? It's really not trivial for two reasons. One is that how do you get this broad range of time constants? Secondly, I told you that the connections are dense, right? So about 65% of connections are present. OS all talk to each other. How do you get this spatial localization of time constants in spite of this intense feedback loops, right? In contrast, why don't you see everywhere you go a mixture of short and long time constants in more or less the same way? So this is a problem that we call spatial localization of timescales. I'm going to skip the detail of a math work, but maybe more interested in show you some unpublished results, how we try to quantify that mathematically and apply a particular measure, which we applied to the model, but perhaps also to the real data. So here, think about this system has been essentially a linear system, right? Actually, the model we used initially is a threshold linear model for which you can define time constants rigorously in terms of eigenvalues, right? For a linear system, you have eigenmodes, and the time constants are given by inverse of the real parts, right, of the eigenvalues. So each time constant corresponds to an eigenvector, if you like, right? So let's consider an eigenvector k with n components, let's say normalized. In physics, there's a measure about localization, given by this number called the inverse participation ratio, which is simply the sum of this component to the power of 4. So the idea is that, for example, if you have a vector that's purely localized, one at one node and zero elsewhere, then this measure is 1. Okay. But it does not, so basically it tells you the fraction of nodes that participate in each particular mode, all right? On the other hand, for example, if you are uniformly distributed, so there's no localization, right? All the nodes participate in this particular mode, then IPR is 1 over n, very small, 0, right? So it's between 0 and 1, if you like. But it does not tell you that the nodes that participate in an eigenmode, whether they are spatially together or not. So Lewis in my lab introduced a slightly different measure that includes this distance between nodes. Okay, and so this would allow you to measure spatial localization, as illustrated by again the same examples. So with a very localized eigenmode, SL is 1, whereas if you have no localization, then SEL is going to be roughly 1 over n squared. It will be very small when n is large, right? And here, more visualized examples. Okay, we also define this data, which is the ratio of SEL divided by IPR to the power 2. So for example, you start with the red example. This is nodes. This is a eigenmode. You see that for this red example, it's very localized, and also nodes are together, right, in space. So IPR is close to 1, SL is close to 1, theta, this ratio is also 1. Another example is the blue example. It's a bit less localized, but they are together in space, right? So IPR is now small, much smaller than 1. SL is also small, but theta is actually close to 1 because they are together, right? The nodes are together. In contrast, in the green case, actually IPR is about the same as the blue, but they are split in space, right? So in this case, SL is really, really small, and theta is small, right? Okay, and so we applied this measure to the real, you know, dynamical model I described to you. Let me explain that. So this is the network. Each dot here is one eigenmode. The color indicates the time constant in log plot, right? So bright color is very slow mode, and the blue color is fast mode. This is log of IPR, localization measure, and y-axis is theta, measuring spatial localization, right? So again, each dot corresponds to eigenmode. You can ask, how is this mode, for example, distributed in space? Well, the answer is this, very, very localized, right? And it's very slow mode, right? So theta is almost one, spatially very localized, and IPR is also rather big, so it's rather localized. Log plot is close to zero, right? Okay. On the other hand, this is a contrasting example, right? Both theta and IPR are low, and you see that it's spatially spread out, right? And it's interesting, perhaps, to look at this and try to figure out again what are the properties that give a rise to this this kind of spatial localization of eigenmodes, and what are the functional implications we can think about. Well, for that, I would like to spend 2 minutes talking about the functional connectivity, because I really believe it's a big deal. And you'll see why I believe that way, and so we can discuss this. So in the model, we can compute functional connectivity. So areas are all driven by noise, and you can compute the correlation of activities between any pair of areas, right? And so this is the functional connectivity measured from the model simulation, area to area, right? Each one corresponds to the correlation of activities between this area and that area. Does that make sense? Now, if we did same thing, same simulations, but now assuming there is no macroscopic gradient, in that case, you still have the same long-distance connectivity matrix, but the areas are identical, are the same nodes, right? And that's what you get on the left. And it's very different from the control case, right? I would argue that this case actually is closer to structure connectivity, because it's really dictated by long-distance structure connectivity matrix, right? And people who study and analyze functional connectivity somehow, sometimes using, say, network science approach, implicitly think about nodes being identical, right? What I'm saying is that maybe that's not quite true. If you believe the story of macroscopic gradients, that areas actually are somewhat different, there's perhaps a way to deal with that when we analyze functional connectivity by taking into consideration of the fact that certain properties change from area to area, right? I'm going to elaborate this idea of macroscopic gradients in the next 10 minutes or so. How can we pursue this idea of macroscopic gradients? You see, each area has a lot of biological properties. Ion channels of single neurons, molecules about synaptic excitation, molecules about synaptic depression, or excitation versus inhibition, right? Intracellular properties. A lot of things depend on molecular makeup, which may change from area to area. So if you quantify each area by all these properties, you're working in high-dimensional space. Each axis corresponds to a particular property, right? And there are heterogeneities. How can we go about analyzing this kind of heterogeneity across cortical areas? Further challenge is that for some species, like even human species, we don't have a good notion of hierarchy, right? Unlike the macaque, it becomes a little bit more difficult to try to identify certain axes along which certain properties change systematically, right? A former student in my lab, John Murray, who is now a faculty at Yale, who did this analysis of single neurons showing hierarchy of time constants, right? He decided to look at human data actually to see if there's microscopic gradients in human cortex. The way he went about doing that in his group is based on, first, a way to define hierarchy in human cortex based on this work by Matt Glaser and Van Nissen. What they noted is that there's this structure measure called T1, T2 ratio from the functional MRI measurement that seemed to, you know, roughly correspond to what you would expect along a hierarchy. High in the visual cortex and low in the prefrontal cortex, right? So what they did is to look at the, you know, T1, T2 ratio that you can measure with functional MRI, with MRI, and look at the macaque T1, T2 ratio data, for which, for macaque, you have the ground truth, right? The way I talked to you about how Henry Kennedy defined the hierarchy. So they compared the T1, T2 ratio with the hierarchy defined by the Kennedy group, and they found a very strong correlation between those two measurements, right? So namely, if an area is low in the hierarchy, the T1, T2 ratio is going to be high. If you're high in the hierarchy, the T1, T2 ratio is going to be low, right? They say, well, this is pretty good. Let's take this as a proxy for hierarchy, for human cortex, right, and see if certain properties change along this direction systematically, right? And what is something, right? Let me skip this slide. This something is gene expression. So they used genetic data from the Allen Institute, postmodern human cortical tissues. Let's say they look at the 16,000 genes that are expressed in the cortex, in the brain, right? So each for each postulated cortical area, you have a level of gene expression for each gene. You have this big matrix, right? Right along the y-axis are the genes, along the x-axis are the cortical areas. Now, you can do a lot of things with this matrix. For example, you can do some kind of principal component analysis and ask whether the first principal component is big, and then other components are smaller, etc., right? And what are they? What do they correspond to? Well, one thing I want to show is that the first principal component from this matrix correlates very well with the T1, T2 ratio, right? Suggesting, again, even the collective gene expression, right, seem to change systematically along certain low-dimensional axes like T1, T2 ratio, which is quite interesting, right? It's not random heterogeneity. So then they went about looking at individual genes that are important for physiologically, say for excitation or inhibition. For example, I talked about NMDA receptors, right? Which are important for working memory, decision making, and plasticity. One of the subtypes of NMDA receptors include this subunit 2B, very important for plasticity, and they found that the gene expression level for 2B subunit changes systematically along the hierarchy, right? And so for each one particular gene, you can look at this and come up with this, Pearson correlation coefficient. This is what's shown here is the correlation for each of the genes that are coding different subunits of NMDA receptors or maybe receptor subunits, as well as GABA receptors. So just to show that indeed, for those markers that are important for excitation on the left and inhibition on the right, you have this systematic changes, right, at the macroscopic level. So we carried out similar analysis for mice, for which, again, hierarchy is not so obvious, right? So we first look at the T1, T2 ratio, and then analyzed gene expressions that are important for excitation and inhibition, and we found also various microscopic gradients. And I think it's only the beginning, but I think it's very interesting to think about the functional implications of those kind of macroscopic gradients, right? So, if you care about, say, metabotropic receptor, which is a very interesting underappreciated and understudied type of a glutamate receptor, which is implicated, say, in schizophrenia and the depression, you can ask, are the metabotropic receptor expression levels change systematically along this hierarchy, for example, right? And the same group led by Jiang Murray tried to see whether macroscopic gradients would have important implications when you look at the functional connectivity of resting state in the human experiments. Actually, several groups have been developing this kind of computational platform, including Gustavo Deiko, Victor Jesser in Europe, to try to develop this kind of model and then contrast or test this kind of model using resting state measurements. Right? So the idea is that you start with structure connectivity, usually so far, using this DTI database, which has some limitations, as I mentioned. For example, connectivity matrix is symmetrical, is not directed, and also the weights sometimes have low signal-to-noise ratio. But if you take whatever is available, say for human, and then you build a model, a dynamical model, right, and compute functional connectivity of this model, and compare that with, say, measurements from functional imaging in the resting state when the subjects are not doing much, not carrying out a cognitive task, for example. So one step in this process is to convert, say, the fine rates or whatever you have in the model into the Bode signal. And that can be done using the so-called Balogne model, right, developed by Carl Friston. So using this Balogne model, you can actually compute the Bode signal from the model and then compare with the real data. So let me show you one result from this new paper from Jiang Murray, which is now in press in Neuro. So in this case, let's first look at the model and also the experiment. The great thing is that they do both things, experiment and the model, and use the same measurements, I mean, same quantity to compare, right? So in this example, for each area, they define a measure of connectivity, a sum of functional connectivity from all the other areas to this particular area, I, right? So for each area, you get one number, right? That's this number, right? Reflecting the summated functional connectivity from the rest of the brain, if you like, right? And then you can ask, can I account for this kind of data better in the model with or without a gradient in the model, right? So when they introduce the gradient, so far, they introduce a very simple gradient of excitation and inhibition in the local circuit, right? What they found basically is that when there's no gradient in the heterogeneous case, you can compute this GPC for each area, right, plotted against the empirical observed GPC from the experiment, right? So you get each dot for each area, you can see how well they are correlated measure of fitness, right, of model with data. And here the correlation is 0.5 or so. But now if they introduce heterogeneity, you know, adjusting the fact that you have additional parameters, right, so do it right, they found that the correlation now is much higher, right, now more than 0.7, suggesting that indeed in a model when you incorporate these macroscopic gradients, you will do better. If you want to say, fit your model with Bode signal measurements in the resting state. Let me just show you one more slide, and maybe we can have some time for discussions. This is a study from David Lewis' group in Pittsburgh, where they analyzed the gene expressions of human tissue in the control subjects for four areas. What they did is to, you know, basically look at the gene expression of multiple molecules that encode multiple molecules important for excitation. And they came up with a composite measure of excitation. So you get one number for each of the four areas in the black bar, right? And you see this hierarchy, right? Or not hierarchy, but macroscopical gradient, right? Low in V1, higher in V2, and much higher in posterior parietal cortex and prefrontal cortex, excuse me. And they did the same thing with inhibition. You see a decreased gradient in open circle. They did the same thing with postmodern tissue from schizophrenic patients. What you get is the open bars. Right? It's pretty obvious that the gradient is gone, basically, for excitation in schizophrenic patients, and somehow become steeper for inhibition in schizophrenic patients. So, you know, they were not really talking in terms of microscopic gradients. They only look at the four areas, but I think it's quite interesting, right, to think maybe to some degree heterogeneities, complexity of cortical areas to some degree can be analyzed in a rather simple way if you think in terms of microscopic gradients. Let me thank people who did this line of work and then be happy to take questions. So I mentioned that Rishi was the graduate student who started to build this dynamical model in collaboration with other people like John Murray, and Francis was the one who developed this class of mathematical models for structured networks. And Luis was the one who has been studying more mathematically the mathematical properties required to generate this localization of time constants. Rishi did similar work. Ben in Australia collaborated with us for the analysis of gene expressions in mice. And Henry is a collaborator who continue to analyze connectivity. And in a couple of years, we'll have this connectivity data, this directed weighted connectivity matrix for the whole macaque cortex. Thank you.